Good evening, everyone. I'm Lina Ormudu. Welcome to Health Chat. The United Nations World Food Programme has issued a warning that hunger in South Sudan may double due to drought and a collapsing economy. In the DRC, observers say the situation is dire. Refugee and internally displaced people are in critical need of health care and other important means for their well-being. What is going on in South Sudan, in the DRC, and other countries in Sub-Saharan Africa that are really dealing with the issue of internally displaced people and refugees? We will look at this issue today with our guest, Silke Pitch. She is Technical Director of Action Against Hunger, a global humanitarian organization committed to ending world hunger, among other things. Ms. Page, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nina. Nice to be with you.
Great. Let me remind our listeners, if you have questions or comments, you can email us at healthchat@voanews.com or post them on facebook.com/healthchatvoa. We will discuss this issue of health care for the internally displaced people and refugees in a moment. But first, VOA's Boniface Itaba has this report from Uganda.
Dr. Usaid Bourda, known by its French acronym MSF, provides basic medical care to refugees living in the district poor refugees camps. Jasper Adotas, a nurse supervisor for MSF, hand out medicine to children diagnosed with a range of illness. Adotas said there are probably a dozen more children and adults who need medical care, but MSF does not have the resource to reach all of them.
We had challenges with staffs, and we are still working on trying to recruit many more staffs to come in, and we plan to have a 24-hour service when we shift to our new environment. However, we also have some challenges with our drugs. Some drugs are going out of stock because we are experiencing quite a large number of patients coming in.
Adota said it is not unusual to see up to 150 patients on weekly days and 120 on weekends. And she said they expect that to go up soon as the rainy season moves into full swings. The heavy rain brings an increase in mosquitoes that transmit malaria. He said MSF is working on erecting new health centers in all four camps. Construction has already begun. They hope to have them in place before the rain increase in April.
Our operations is pretty organized, and we are going to manage the patients in this camp very well, because we're not only running this camp, we have other camps like New Manzi, Baratuku, and we are running it all well.
But MSF cannot meet the need of all the 10,000 of refugees living in the camps. Despite the health concern, William Mabiodengs, the chairperson of Ayilo refugees camp, conditions are better than they have been for many refugees.
It is improving. There were some public latrines ducked by the UN agencies in this place.
Deng said now that the rain have started, there is no time for the refugees to consider relocating or moving to permanent settlement with a better health service. He said they will just hope for the best. For VOA News, I'm Boniface Yetaban in Kampala.
And Ms. Peach, again, welcome to the show. Now, we heard this report about what is happening in an area in South Sudan with the refugee. So basically what we hear is how challenging the situation is for MSF that is providing care for these people there. So not only MSF, but an organization like yours, Action Against Hunger, that has been working on the ground, is also confronted with challenges. Tell us about, first of all, your reaction to what you heard in terms of what is happening on the ground with the challenges in providing health care.
Yes, I think there is a variety of challenges out there. Primary, of course, we have a large number of people, a large proportion of the population being displaced in this area, so they're away from home in shift-make shelters and camp settings where there's a high density of population. So you already have a higher density of the population than you would usually have. In addition, we have, as the humanitarian organization, we have a lot of problems to access those areas just by security. For instance, we have challenges to get supplies there, medical supplies, treatment of undernutrition, treatment products, we have kind of complications to simply logistically get the resources we need and the supply we need to this area. Now, this is already a complicated situation in the current situation. Now, as your reporter mentioned, we're moving into the rainy season, and that will increase the dangers or the risk of any waterborne diseases, for instance. So we will see an increase in probably diarrhea and waterborne infections. We will see an increase in malaria. So we will have an increased need for treatment and for supplies needed out there in the camps.
Okay. Now, when we go to the situation of South Sudan, which is what I mentioned in the beginning of the show, the United Nations World Food Programme has issued a warning that hunger may be doubling due to drought. What is the situation in South Sudan? What can you tell us?
Right. So the World Food Programme, as well as lots of the partners on the ground, we meet on a regular basis and we look at information that is available and trying to update the analysis of the situation and the prediction of what will happen next. So all of us are very, very concerned. We're talking about 5 million people who are in need of humanitarian aid. 3 million out of those are in need of acute food support. They're in severe food crisis and hunger. So we're very concerned about those, and we must act immediately to address those needs, especially while we're moving into the lean season. Again, this is obviously a problem in terms of access to the affected population, but as well in terms of the funding level of South Sudan and the crisis. We see a very low level of funding at this point of time. The appeal for the United Nations appeal for 2016 in South Sudan is only funded at 29%. So it's very, very low level for the United Nations themselves to receive donations from different governments to actually respond to this crisis. So South Sudan is significantly underfunded overall, and that is a major concern while we're moving into the lean season now.
So looking at South Sudan again, if we want to go specific, what are the issues that you are addressing now? I know you mentioned funding is a challenge for humanitarian organizations. What is South Sudan dealing with? They've been going through a political crisis. What are you dealing with as a humanitarian organization?
So we have South Sudan has two crises ongoing at the same time, as you wish. We have an area mostly in the western part of the country where we are struggling with a chronic crisis, a protracted crisis, where since many, many years there has been implications from the past wars, and people have failed to recover. So we're still supporting the situation in the western parts with treatment of undernutrition. We still have very high rates of undernutrition there. We're supporting with water and sanitation, rehabilitating water points. We're supporting with agricultural support to reinforce the production and so on. But we have as well the very acute crisis linked to the current fighting in the eastern parts of the country, where we see a high load of population being displaced or in very dire needs. So in these areas, we are very acutely focusing on the health side. We're focusing on treating undernutrition, which is very high there as well. And we're focusing on food assistance some of the key problems we see is as well mental health aspect, psychosocial support to those displaced populations. They have lost family members. They have lost their livelihoods. So we see a lot of trauma as well in the population that is displaced, which is of high concern to us.
Very interesting you mentioned mental health, because a lot of times when we talk about addressing health challenges for refugees and IDPs, I don't see mental illness very much as part of the problem. Often we talk about nutrition and other things. So can you elaborate a little more on the mental illness aspect of this?
So I wouldn't go into the degree of saying it's mental illnesses. We are worried about their mental state because they have been displaced from home. They're under high stress levels. They have been exposed to conflict. Uh-huh. They have maybe seen family members being shot dead, you know. So there is a very high level of exposure. There's a high need for protection of those populations. We need to provide them with a safe space where they can feel safe, where they can start dealing with their trauma and working on that, where they're able to actually take care of their family members. Very often, every person reacts differently to high stress levels and to trauma. So it's very common for the human being to be affected and be traumatized and paralyzed in what we need to do every day. You know, we fail to take care, we get depressed, we are concerned, we can't think forward, we can't take care of our families and think about what we're going to eat tomorrow, for instance. So trauma affects each of us differently. So it's important for us, in link with the undernutrition and caretaking of the children under 5 years of age or the adolescent kind of youngsters there, that the larger and the adult family and the adult population is able to regain control over their lives, you know, and support them in the process of gaining back their full capacity. So it's a matter of psychosocial support, where sometimes it might be enough to create a safe space for mothers, pregnant and lactating mothers, who can come together and talk about things, you know, animate a conversation about what they have experienced, trying to help them in the situation to work off their experiences and come to terms with what has happened if they've lost family members, for instance. So it's really psychosocial support and creating that safe space where people can feel safe to talk and to be together in these camps or in places where population is accumulating.
Do you find that people feel safe when they are relocated to camp, or do they still have the trauma of maybe having to deal with the issue that they left behind?
So the camps that are the managed camps at this point of time are often a safe haven for populations. So you will see families who actively move towards those camps to be on safer ground. Those camps are protected by peacekeeping forces, so there is a minimum level of protection for these arrangements. So you'll see a lot of population moving towards those camps because they feel safer there than in their own homesteads or in the woods, for instance. So that's an important thing to consider. Now, they will probably take longer to overcome the fear, the trauma, the stress levels that they have experienced from coming from their homesteads to these protected camps. And there will probably be longer-term needs to kind of work with the population. We see that in many conflict-affected populations that stress levels and trauma will linger, and we need to continue to work on this. So this is one of the key aspects, which, as you mentioned, is not always actually paid attention to in terms of how do we engage, how do we ensure people's well-being, overall health and well-being, is as well supported by the kind of mental support, the mental health kind of side of things.
Now, when we look at addressing malnutrition, we know that very often there are some supplies that are given to people, that are the children and the parents and men and women that are undergoing malnutrition. Can you take us through some of the nutrients that are being provided in the case of malnutrition?
Right. So we make a difference between a child that is already undernourished and needs to be treated. It's like in medical treatment. It receives certain therapeutic foods, which are very rich in protein, in fat. They're fortified with micronutrients, vitamin A, iron, zinc, to make sure they have a complete package of what they're consuming every day. So it's basically an extra fat diet for them to kind of re-pep up again and gain weight and become healthy. So these are the kids that are already undernourished. Now, we have as well parts of the children population, or even the adult population, which might risk of undernutrition. So they're not yet undernourished, but they're already quite skinny. So we will support them with more nutritious foods. You very often have corn soy blend, which is fortified with micronutrients as well, and which is prepared with oil and probably sugar to make it a bit more palatable. So again, we have the strong kind of protein side of things, micronutrients, vitamins, minerals, which are fortified, to make sure we're able to cover that. In addition to that, you very often have a family food basket where you'll have cereals, you will have pulses like beans or lentils, you'll have oil and some condiments in there to support the overall family basket. Depending on if you have markets close by, which are functions, You might be able to integrate some fresh vegetables or fresh fruits, some meat or milk products or eggs into that food basket to the family. That will depend on the local context, of course. But we're trying as much to ensure that there is a balanced, locally acceptable diet available in those food assistance baskets.
Okay. And Ms. Page, we will continue the discussion. We have to take a short break when we come back. So we will talk more. Don't go away. We will address on the DRC when we come back. It's now time for a break, and we will have the news with Sanusi Diallo.
United Global Health Initiative launched a new multi-million dollar initiative to finance new treatment that can prevent the onset of full-blown tuberculosis in hundreds of millions of people globally living with latent TB. The executive director, Lelio Marmora, said the organization is prepared to spend between $40 and $80 million on innovative proposal that could provide simpler, shorter, and cheaper treatment for people who are at high risk of developing tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is a highly infectious airborne disease that kills some 1.5 million people every year. New data show life expectancy rose by 5 years between 2000 and 2015, the fastest increase since 1960s. But the World Health Organization has just issued its latest World Health Statistics report, find major inequality persist both within and among countries, despite people living an average of 5 years longer now than before the turn of the century. Switzerland, Iceland, Austria, Sweden and Israel are the five countries with the highest life expectancy at birth, while Chad, Ivory Coast, Central African Republic, Angola and Sierra Leone are the lowest rank. A group of Nigerian scientists has come up with a new simple method of diagnosing malaria. This marked the first time urine, not blood, is used to test for malaria. With a urine test kit, one can diagnose malaria by merely putting a stripe in a small container of urine. A line shows on the stripe if one has the malaria parasite, unlike the old method, which requires health personnel to carry out malaria tests. People can now test themselves for the disease at home. And that's the wrap-up of the latest health news.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late, tonight's topic on Health Chat is we are looking at addressing the healthcare of the internally displaced people and refugees. And our guest is Silke Pitch, Technical Director of Action Against Hunger, a global humanitarian organization committed to ending world hunger. Ms. Pitch, before the break, we talked about the situation in South Sudan. And before we move to DRC, let me ask you this. Do you anticipate the situation in South Sudan to improve or get worse within the next year?
So, looking at the public health situation we have now and the hunger levels we have now, as we mentioned earlier, we're moving into the hunger season now. So food will significantly reduce. People will run out of stocks, so they will rely or will need to rely more on humanitarian aid. We'll see an increase in waterborne diseases, malaria due to the rainy season. So this will confound the situation and the hunger and undernutrition we see. If people become sick, their bodies, their immune system will even be less reactive and able to defend themselves. So they'll, and being undernourished, that will contribute to each other. It's like a vicious circle. So we're very concerned about the situation. Already now, plus the rainy season kicking in now, it will be probably a deterioration of what we see. So we absolutely need to step up the interventions we have and the humanitarian community, the different actors and stakeholders on the ground need to work together to make that happen. We'll need more funding commitments from donors. We will need access to the population. We'll need kind of be able to go there and to be able to supply the services we have. But we must react now to not let down South Sudan and the population in need.
Very good point. The humanitarian, the World Humanitarian Assembly just ended today, which took place in Istanbul. And the humanitarian community today is confronted with so many different challenges, right? So where do we see priorities? How do you determine the priorities? How do you spread the resources? It must be a challenge, isn't it?
It is very complicated. We have many more crises ongoing now than we had maybe a decade ago. So it's really important to have systems which we can use to classify and to categorize different crises and people in each of these crises in terms of their needs. So there is lots of efforts across the humanitarian community and the different stakeholders to consolidate that and come to a consensus to look at the different crises and classifying those. The FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, is leading the integrated phase classification of food security and emergencies. So this project has a number of partners on board looking at the different crises, trying to prioritize areas and populations in need. You, of course, will always have a difference in terms of natural kind of disasters like droughts or floods or volcanoes, for instance, or hurricanes, and man-made disasters with conflict. So very often we, as a humanitarians, we are stuck in situations where we need decision makers to provide and support political solutions to the problem so humanitarians can actually take care of the population.
Now, moving to the DRC, some observers say the situation is dire. What does your organization find on the ground working in the DRC?
The DRC is a very, very special case. It's a very long, ongoing crisis as well. It's very protracted. It's a very, very large country. It is very difficult to access just by infrastructure in terms of getting around. So it's hard to get to the population. We still see some conflict-related crisis aspects and displacement in the eastern parts and the Kivus of the country. We'll have massive needs and chronic crisis in all, most of the country without the conflict, even just by poverty levels. It's very, very low human development index levels across the country. So you have a chronic crisis, already chronic underlying crisis with additional acute displacement crisis as well. So the coping capacity of the population is very, very low. They have great fertile soils for production, but they can't access the fields due to conflict, or they can't afford any agriculture inputs to start the agriculture season. So it's very confounded, and it's very difficult and complex to respond to that. Congo, similar to South Sudan, is a very underfunded crisis. We call it a forgotten crisis, as it belongs to those who have been ongoing for a long, long time and have been overshadowed by the new crisis, the more acute crisis like the Middle East with the Greater Syria crisis, for instance. So it's really difficult.
So when you look at the situation in sub-Saharan Africa, what countries or what crises would you say are more urgent than others in terms of addressing them?
We must look at the overall population that is affected in terms of numbers, total numbers of population that are affected, and the level of the crisis affecting not only the people directly, but their livelihoods as well, and the knock-on effects. It's clear that the global humanitarian system has not unlimited resources, so there will be an end to resources. You know, it's a closed system. We cannot continue kind of printing money and being able to respond. But there's a need to ensure that the minimum needs are covered of the population. We very often see as well a very late response to natural disasters. Look at a drought, for instance, because we're hoping that the situation will improve, but it won't. And the longer we wait, the more expensive the response becomes. If we would invest more into preparedness and contingency planning and reacting early to needs, it would probably be a better money for value than waiting until we have a full-blown humanitarian crisis where we need to respond to, which is way more expensive.
Mm-hmm. And the situation in the DRC has been ongoing for a while. So in a case like this, what do you do? How do you address such a crisis that has been going on for such a long time, and the country is so wide and big, and what do you do?
Well, we need to be there. We need to advocate for the mothers and fathers, you know, their family as we have it as well, and they're in dire need to make their living and take care of their families. So it's important to keep in mind that they're not just numbers, but people out there who are facing severe levels of hunger, which many of us might not have experienced and hopefully will never experience in our lives. So it's a matter of ensuring that the larger public is as well aware of what's going on. We have the World Humanitarian Summit going on as we speak this week in Istanbul, as you mentioned. So there is spaces where discussions need to happen, and the larger public of this world and the civil societies of the different countries need to be active and advocate with donors, with their governments to better take care of their populations in need.
What about the collaboration that you have with countries on the ground? How does this work? Do you see that countries are easy to work with, or do you just go in and do what you have to do and get out? Is there a collaboration with countries?
Generally, we work with national governments, with Ministry of Health, for instance, for the undernutrition treatment. We try to, as much as possible, integrate the treatment into the existing health services. That is trying as well to create sustainability of these services. You know, if we go in and we provide the service and the moment we go, it will break down. That's not our idea. We'd like to leave something behind. We want to prepare the system and develop and build the capacity of the system in country to take care of the population. So to be able to take care of the undernourished kids in the future, we want to work with the communities to build there, not only help them recover from a crisis, but beyond that, work on their resilience, you know, and prepare them for the future shocks so they're able to cope better with it the next time. So we're very closely working with the local governments, the different ministries, which are in line management for our interventions, like the nutrition and health or the agriculture and the livestock side, the water and sanitation side. So we always work very closely with those.
And finally, when you look at the way things stand, whether in the DRC or in South Sudan, moving forward, what would you say should be the priority? I know you mentioned the fact that the humanitarian community needs to step up. We need funding. We need access to some of this remote population. What else needs to be done if we could pinpoint one, two, or three steps?
Well, I think one of the key elements in the world, Lina, would be peace at the moment. So if we
yes.
could have peace.
Don't we wish there was peace, world peace?
Yeah, I would vote for real world peace if I have to do one key thing. No, but I think there's as well a need to improve our ways of working in terms of how we work the humanitarian sector and how we work with the development sector. There tends to be this split or perceived split of responsibility where the emergency team, the humanitarians, are in charge of saving lives and starting the recovery, and the development partners will only take that population forward, those families, once they're fully recovered. So we need to integrate that collaboration better. We need to integrate the funding streams from humanitarian and development funding through donors better to ensure we have a continuum of care for those families and the population that is affected by recurrent humanitarian situations and emergency, and who we want to start building their own capacities to to do better in the future.
Okay, Ms. Peach, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Lena.
Great. And we thank our guest, Silke Peach. She is Technical Director of Action Against Hunger, a global humanitarian organization committed to end world hunger. That's all for today. Thanks to all our listeners for joining us. As always, we appreciate you joining us every Tuesday on Health Chat. I'm your host, Lina Mudu, in Washington, with producer Kwame Ofori and Sanusi Diallo for the news. Until next time, take care, be well, and strong. Strive to make every day a healthy day.